be seated. Good morning. This is the time set for oral argument in Royal Essex versus Azteca 87401. Council is familiar, I assume, with the 17-minute per side rules. So I won't go through it unless either of you indicates you're not familiar. Okay, very well. You may begin. Please tell the clerk how much time you want to reserve for
Four rebuttal. Minutes, please. Good morning, Justice Pickering, Chief Justice Herndon, and Justice Kadish. My name is David Snyder. On behalf of the appellants with me today is trial counsel Brian Blankenship. May it please the court. This is not the first time that the questions that this appeal presents have been before this court. A year and a half ago, the court decided Further South LLC versus Royal Essex, docket number 84544. There, this court concluded that a Class A common unit holder, Further South, could prove no set of facts whereby it would receive a distribution from the Essex bankruptcy estate, nor could it prove that any royal appellate action caused it any damages. And the court based its conclusion on three findings. First, that the Nevada Secretary of State had revoked that member's charter, that that member had failed to demonstrate that it was willing and able to exercise its purchase option rights and its refusal rights under the Essex operating agreement, and that that member would not receive a distribution under any version of the Essex operating agreement because the bankruptcy state itself did not have enough funds to pay higher priority claimants. Now, interestingly, on January 13th, 2022, during the district court's hearing on Royal Appellant's first summary judgment motion, my colleague here, Mr. Garner, stated that the Further South dismissal order would not control this case until this court ruled on it. It's on volume 5, page 915 to 916. And I agree with what Mr. Garner said 3 years ago. I think that Further South should guide this panel's decision because this matter's dispositive facts are identical. I think a contrary conclusion, frankly, would introduce a jurisprudential dissonance that reason and the law cannot abide. Now, we made two arguments on appeal, and I want to briefly address our summary judgment argument before I turn to the district court's finding of facts, conclusions of law, and judgment. We argued that the district court's refusal to grant summary judgment on four occasions, notwithstanding Azteca's failure to proffer any evidence of lost profit damages, was an error. And, you know, we made this argument throughout our opening brief. It's in our jurisdictional statement on page 1, our issue statement on page 2. It's in our case statement on page 4 and 5. It's in our, we summarized all the summary judgment movement papers on pages 27 to 36. It's in our argument summary. It's in the legal standard. It's in our argument. It's in our conclusion.
How is that live since you went on ahead to trial?
Well, I think under Russ versus Clark County School District, a party can challenge interlocutory orders in an appeal from a final judgment. And in that case, the appellants challenged the district court's refusal to grant summary judgment after the matter had gone to trial, and the court granted relief on that ground. I think the alternative would be to force parties to file mandamus.
If it were a purely legal question, that's something, but you went ahead and had a factual trial that the district judge heard evidence. Do you think that there was enough evidence adduced at trial to support its judgment?
No, I don't. And if you are seeking me to move on, Justice Pickering, I can address that. I mean, here there are three causal grounds that Azteca argues of rights that it had under the Essex agreement that were harmed or that were infringed upon that caused its lost profit damages. And it was its voting rights under Essex operating agreement section 5.05, its purchase option rights under Essex operating agreement section 7.05, and its right of first of refusal under operating agreement section 7.04. Now, the problem here is that the Nevada Secretary of State revoked Azteca's charter in 2009. And that has implications not only under Nevada statute, but also under the Essex operating agreement itself. The operating agreement section 7.05, subsection A1 provides that if a member becomes an affected unit holder, either bankruptcy, dissolved, or liquidated, then it loses its voting rights.
Is a Secretary of State revocation the same as one of those three listed items?
So the operating agreement doesn't expressly define what constitutes a dissolved entity under the operating agreement.
Are articles of dissolution filed with the Secretary of State?
No, what happened here is that Azteca failed to pay its dues. And after failing to pay its dues after a number of years, the Secretary of State suspended its ability to conduct business.
It still could have become reinstated, couldn't it?
It could, but it didn't right. Under these facts. It remained a defunct entity, if you will, up and through all of the transactions that Azteca assigns heir to.
Would you agree that court. Under Chapter 86, dissolution is different from revocation?
I think that under these facts, what they're alleging is that with their charter being revoked, it rendered them unable to conduct business, regardless of whether they were dissolved or revoked. And here they're arguing that we were unable to purchase something. Well, if your charter is revoked...
My question was different. Under Chapter 86, would you agree that... Are you contending that revocation and dissolution are two different... Are the same thing?
I think that... I don't have an answer for your question, Justice Pickering. I apologize. I'm not sure.
Okay.
What I would say is that when we look up, if we try to define the term in the Essex Operating Agreement, what constitutes a dissolved entity, the Black's Law Dictionary plainly defines that it includes an entity whose charter is revoked. And I think it must because...
Yeah, I think you're right on if we read Black's Law Dictionary, my question is the statutes that govern it suggest that it's two steps. There's revocation and there's dissolution, and those are two different things.
I understand. Even if the charter under these instances is revoked, however, it still does seem that Azteca would not have been able to perform the things it claimed it could have during this time period, given that its charter was revoked. How would it have been able to acquire interest in something when Nevada law prohibited it from doing so under those circumstances?
But it could reinstate.
It could have, but it didn't under these circumstances.
But it didn't have the reason to because the facts were being hidden, right?
Well, I think that on December 11th, 2019, and the record bears this out. Let me find a citation for the court for your convenience. On December 11th, 2019, Mr. Holman did contact Mr. Blay. He reached out to him on LinkedIn. This is in volume 24, page 4251 of the record. And for whatever reason, Mr. Blay did not respond until February 7th, 2020. And so that notice happened before they ultimately, Royal Appellants ultimately completed.
What was the nature of that communication?
George Holman notified Mr. Blaya that he reached out to him and told him to contact him, that he wanted to speak with him. It wasn't explicit about, obviously, anything in this case. But that was
Mr. Snyder, to the question and answer that you were having with Justice Pickering, assuming the revocation itself isn't enough, what party, well, not what party, I think we can kind of identify which party it is, but what amount of evidence should be produced, and what, if any, evidence was produced that they could have reinstated or revitalized the charter such that they could have participated?
What we have in this case, based on my reading, is of the testimony that came out in trial was just a bare assertion by Mr. Blaya that he could have reinstated his charter and he could have done all of these things. And If we're transitioning now into what type of showing a party should make when they're seeking lost profit damages when you have a new business, I think there's a great degree of congruity between what you'll find in learned treatises and in case law in other jurisdictions. And the reason that the showing is necessarily higher is because contract damages seek to place the party in the position that they would have occupied but for the breach. Not a better position, not a worse position, the same position. And so a party trying to seek lost profit damages has to show that they were reasonably certain to achieve these profits but for the breach. Not I could have, but I was going to get these profits but for the breach. And I think Corbin on contracts provides a lot of insight into what different jurisdictions do. section 55.12 of volume 11 of that treatise notes that, again, the emphasis is to demonstrate that this profit would have occurred if the breaching action did not happen. And here, what's interesting is that Azteca basically occupied a position of a losing contract before Royal Appellants got involved. Their charter was revoked, so they're unable to transact business at the time. The Inspirata land that's giving rise to all of these different controversies was worth approximately $40 to $50 million, but it was encumbered by an amount at least $220 million. It had a tax lien hanging over it for about $2 to $3 million, and it was facing a county auction to recoup the due tax assessments. And creditors would have gobbled up everything that would have come from that. So if Royal Appellants don't get involved in this transaction, everybody takes nothing.
Well, why couldn't Azteca have done what Royal did, was go and negotiate with the preferred unit holders and say, hey, we can all get nothing, or we can negotiate and we'll go through the efforts to make sure there's something that we can all divide?
I think that a party can make that showing. It's just what kind of quantum of proof is necessary to get there, right? Mm-hmm. And I think this is where, again, the court can find guidance and learn treatises, because I don't think there is a Nevada case that's on point here. Going back to Corbin's on contracts, if you look at section 56.17 of that treatise, it's like, look, you have to provide a higher level of proof to obtain reasonable certainty that the damage was going to exist in terms of lost profits, but for the breach. And generally, this is going to require some sort of expert testimony or an economic or financial data, market analyses, records from similar enterprises, or some other kind of comparison that a jury can actually find or reasonably determine, like, yes, you would have made profit. Because what, absent that type of showing, what does it invite? You know, I just started a business, there was a breach, and I didn't make any money.
I mean, Mr. Lee or Blay, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, he testified, did he not, that he's been involved in transactions like this, he's been involved in negotiations like that. Is that not enough, that he has experience, like this isn't his first rodeo?
I think that here, what the entirety of the testimony shows, that as it pertains to this specific deal, that Mr. Blaya only had one relationship with one lender, in this case, Highland Capital, which had since gone bankrupt. By his own testimony, he had no relationship with any of the Series A preferred members because Mr. Holman had brought them all into.
Did Royal have relationships with the Series A preferred holders before it got involved?
No, they didn't, but they had a charter that was active that allowed them to conduct business, and they had access to capital that would allow them to raise $750,000 to match this purchase option, which Mr. Blay admitted.
Did Azteca show whether it had access to capital, or I guess did it show that it had access to capital?
Only if you're willing to credit his mere testimony that, well, I could have raised that money, but if that's the standard, well, then anybody could satisfy that at trial.
Right.
I tried a thought of an analysis because I know that this example is made through the briefing. That, well, you know, you did it, so why couldn't I do it? And I guess this is more directly for you, Justice Cage, because I know that you're a Jeopardy fan, but I mean, assuming that I had a contract.
Same Corbin kind of rules apply if it's a disgorgement of ill-gotten gain that is sought and it's an equitable remedy?
I don't know that the parties briefed that. I don't know that disgorgement was sought below.
I mean, it's unclear to me exactly what the theory of damages was.
I think my best understanding is that, you know, had you not done all of these things, I could have had this opportunity and I would have gotten this windfall. That's my understanding of what they seem to suggest. And the problem that I found in reviewing this is, go back to disgorgement. I mean, my understanding is disgorgement is where somebody takes money from you and then uses it to gain more money. So you take back what they originally stole from you and the profits they made from it so that you don't damage them.
If they take an opportunity that should have been shared with you and they make money on it, disgorgement would take that money away from them.
I think if you would show that you were going to get that money in the first instance, which I think gets me back to where I am here, I don't see under what circumstances where it was with reasonable certainty that Azteca would have been able to do all these things based on the record that was proper to trial. Again, and I think his testimony mostly runs from, I wish I had the site more handy. Volume 21, page 3604-07. It's just, look, I could have done that. And it spans for about three pages of testimony.
What was the page set again?
3604 to 3607.
That's Mr. Blaya's testimony.
Mr. Blaya's testimony. And, yeah. And look, I'm not saying that a new business can't ever achieve lost profit damages. The weight of authority says otherwise. It's just the question of what burden does a party have to put on to obtain that. And if it were just a mere assertion without robust factual support that, yeah, I could have done that. I mean, back to the example that I was going to give, let's say I had a contract that said I got to appear on Jeopardy. And then there's a breach and I didn't get to go on Jeopardy. Can I go and ask for like $4 million in winnings and say, well, Ken Jennings did it? No, I would have to demonstrate that, I would have to make some sort of comparison.
I'm confident I could not show I would do as well as Ken Jennings.
I don't either, but that's my point, is yes. That what type of burden should somebody seeking lost profit damages when you have a business that never has any established history of making any money? What sort of evidentiary burden should they have to show? I'll leave because I know my time is running short. Actually, I'll just reserve what I have left for rebuttal.
Yep.
Thank you.
Ms. Pickering, Justice Kagan, Mr. Chief Justice, good morning. May it please the court, my name is Rex Garner. I represent Azteca and Danan Blaya, the respondents in this case and the prevailing parties below. This is just one of many cases that arise out of the Essex Real Estate Partners deal, which your colleagues down the street in state and federal bankruptcy court have, and which you have had, past, present, and future. You will see more of these cases. The case today began when the royal parties, the appellants here, filed suit against Azteca and Mr. Blaya seeking declaratory and injunctive relief to prevent them from getting a penny out of Essex's funds to be distributed in Essex's bankruptcy case. Azteca and Blaya countersued Royal and its principals, who claim to enjoy a privileged position within Essex to claim the lion's share of its $18 million windfall. As the evidence, most of it documentary, and most of it admitted by stipulation revealed, however, Royal could only enjoy this purported privileged position through multiple breaches of the operating agreement and through multiple breaches of the Essex manager's fiduciary duty owed to members like Azteca. And the evidence showed that Royal aided and abetted in every one of those breaches, in fact, made some of them a condition of dealing with the manager and one of the founding members. All of this, they argued below and they argue to you now, did not harm Azteca, an original member of Essex, who, as a Class A common member of Essex, enjoyed certain rights, including voting rights, including the right to be informed about Essex business, and the right to have a manager act in its best interest. After a four-day bench trial in which the district court heard testimony from seven witnesses, admitted over 70 documentary exhibits, it entered a 28-page judgment that includes 118 separate findings of fact and 49 conclusions of law.
Here's my question. If they were only able to put themselves in the position to gain that money by these multiple breaches, I presume you're not saying, well, your clients should have had the opportunity and would have engaged in those breaches of duties so that they could be in a position to get that money.
Of course not, Justice.
So how would they have been in the position to get that money without those breaches?
Well, the answer to your question is we're not similarly situated. If Mr. Holman had brought, as the acting manager of Essex, this opportunity to Azteca and others who were original members, that would have been compliance with the operating agreement as opposed to breach of the operating agreement.
Okay. How would your client, let me be more specific.
Yes.
Number one, how would your client have been able to acquire Holman's membership interest? And, well, why don't we start there?
Okay. Start there, Your Honor. Here's where Royal does a little bit of sleight of hand. They would like Azteca to have done the same thing they did as outsiders in buying the Lanco units. Those are the ones that were owned by Mr. Holman and transferred his units. They want to say, well, you should have put up the same $3.75 million that we agreed to. But go back.
If you were offered the right of first refusal, wouldn't it be based on the offer made by someone else?
No. Because you go back to 2018 that Mr. Holman, in his own testimony, said, I dissolved Lanco. I dissolved it in 2018. Dissolution is an express event of default, which triggers Section 7.05 of the operating agreement.
Uh-huh.
That's the first right of first refusal. When it's dissolved, those units have to be offered to the other Class A common members.
At what
one
price?
Of which was Azteca. At what price is a great question. Because what you'll see in the record as well, Your Honor, is that Lanco transferred those units, even though they were dissolved and affected, to Mr. and Mrs. Holman's trust for how much money?
None.
$0.
Oh, right.
So you're
claiming your client would have gotten them for $0?
I'm saying if he was able to transfer them to his trust, why isn't that the price? Why is it not the price that Royal came up with? And if we jump to ahead, though, Your Honor, did Royal have the money? No, it borrowed it from somebody else. Did $750,000 down payment to buy those units and couldn't pay the rest. And you have already had that appeal where you affirmed that they had to give those units back to Holman.
So what would your client have done?
So my client, well, it depends, Your Honor. If the operating agreement had been complied with back in 2018, there would have been some kind of negotiation. And I don't know why we should have had to pay more for those units than the Holman Trust did, or why we are being held to the same standard as Royal, who couldn't pay for them, who defaulted on them, but yet we are supposed to prove that we could have taken advantage of an opportunity that was never presented to
Wasn't
us.
Wasn't Azteca revoked by the Secretary of State at that
yes.
time? So could they have purchased those units without getting reinstated?
I don't know the answer to that, but as your discussion
Seems
earlier,
like maybe we should know that answer by now.
Well, I mean, all of this is going back in time, but as you have pointed out, and as we can all read in NRS 86, reinstatement is a perfunctory matter. You pay the fee, you file your list of officers, and you're back in action.
Right.
But doesn't that right? Isn't that right extinguished after 5 years?
It says that, Your Honor, but there are more entities that have reinstated after 5 years than I could tell you about. And here's the problem. If Royal is correct, that revocation means dissolution, it creates more problems for itself than it solves. And here's why. If you look at the record of all of the other members of Essex that Royal was dealing with at the time, in volume 24, 4390 and 4389 are two charts that Royal created. In that list, it includes their statuses at the time.
Right.
At least one or more of those entities, the Series A preferred members that it was dealing with, were defaulted, revoked, or dissolved.
Okay.
Did Royal believe that prevented them from transacting business? No. If you look at the other chart, they're soliciting their votes for the business of Essex.
Okay. Sorry, I'm going to bring you back to...
Yeah.
Not enough time and a lot of questions.
Sure.
Let's assume that Azteca could have gotten itself reinstated and could have acquired Holman / Landco's units.
Yes.
There's still ultimately no money at the end of the day for this company, absent getting the Series A preferred holders to reduce their amounts.
Correct.
So what evidence is there that your client would have successfully accomplished that without breaching duties under the agreement? And how much then?
How much?
How much would it have gotten? How much would it have been reduced? That's your damages claim, isn't it?
Well, it is, Your Honor, but I don't have to prove what would have been if we had been granted that opportunity because the
isn't
law...
Isn't that what the damages are that you're seeking?
Not entirely. Because the law is very clear in a breach of contract and breach of fiduciary duty, especially fiduciary duty, it's disgorgement of profits is the measure of damages. And this court has said, and adopting the restatement, those who aid and abet in breaches of fiduciary duty or equally liable.
So how much profits did they make that are to be disgorged? Let me back up. I've never seen a judgment like this that doesn't include an amount of the judgment.
Well, that's because, Your Honor, the money that is being held by Essex's bankruptcy has not yet been distributed. It is still being fought over in the bankruptcy court. So we don't know. So what the district court judge did here, it said to Royal, essentially, in its judgment, because you aided and abetted all of these breaches of the contract, all of these breaches of fiduciary duty, you must forfeit. You forfeit anything you stand to gain as a consequence of your wrongdoing. The law will not permit anyone to profit from breaches of contract, from breaches of fiduciary duty.
How did your client establish that absent Royal's breaches and I guess perhaps Holman's breaches, absent all of that, that your client in fact would have been able to make that opportunity happen?
I'll tell you exactly how. If you look at the term sheet that was presented from Royal to the Holman parties, that is volume 23, 4193 to 95. This was a prepackaged deal.
Right.
Mr. Holman had already negotiated with two lawyers to handle the Essex bankruptcy and the litigation against Essex's lenders for a contingency fee. We are going to employ this NRS 106.240, the ancient mortgage statute, which you have subsequently made some determinations. But back in 2019, mm-hmm. it was a different time.
Right.
And so what did it require of anyone, whether it was Azteca or Royal at the very beginning? Holman had already gotten on board an attorney to do it essentially for free on a contingency. So what was required of Royal at the time? Nothing other than to acquire the units that should have been offered to the other members back in 2018.
And then negotiate with the Series
yes.
A preferred holders to reduce it, because otherwise they take it all and your client gets zero.
That's absolutely correct, Justice Gatish. And Royal would have the district court and this court believe that only they
haven't
were
the
able
Series
to
A holders asserted in litigation that they would not have made that agreement if the full facts had been disclosed as they should have been.
I'm sorry, repeat that one more time.
Haven't the Series A preferred holders, it's my understanding, also have brought their own separate litigation.
They have.
Right? And that they, it's my understanding that they argued therein that they would not have agreed to reduce their percentage recovery from any money that came into this company if the opportunity presented to the company had been disclosed to them as it should have been.
I don't know if that precise claim has been made, Your Honor. I know some of the Series A preferreds who sold to Royal have brought suit to rescind that transaction, but
right.
I'm not aware if any Series A preferred member has said, I would not have agreed to cap my recovery if I had been told something else. I don't know if that exists.
And some of them, it's my understanding, pursuant to court rulings, have been, there are orders ordering them to be given their interests back or to regain some interests, I believe.
Yes, with respect to any transfers of their interest to a royal entity,
right.
I don't know that there's been any judgment on the specific voting for the cap.
Got it.
On it. But to more further answer your question, Justice Kadish, Azteca and George Holman and the other Class A common members put this deal together in the first place. They're the ones who gathered the Series A preferred members back in 2007. When Royal showed up, they were complete strangers to all the original members of Essex. So Royal would have you believe that as outsiders, as strangers, they accomplished something that the gentlemen who were the original working class members of this entity could not have accomplished.
But doesn't your client have to actually show with evidence that that's the case, that in fact it would have been able to do this?
I'm not sure they do, Your Honor, other than I think it's not a far cry to realize that whatever Royal accomplished could have been accomplished by the original members of Essex. They didn't do anything special other than talk to those members. And how are we supposed to prove that we could have done something back in 2019 and exploited an opportunity that was never presented to us, which is why the law on breach of contract and breach of fiduciary duty, one of the measures is disgorgement. We don't have to go out and prove that we would have done better or different. All we have to do is prove the amount of money that you, Royal, want to extract from Essex is ill-gotten gains.
Isn't some of that ill-gotten gain at the expense of the Series A preferred holders or the other Class A common holders, not other than your client? Like, why does your client get all of that?
Well, I'm not sure that it will, Your Honor. And the money is still in the Essex bankruptcy, still being fought over. But for sure, what Judge Denton's order did was say, you, Royal, as the wrongdoers, are not allowed to take from Essex's coffers, and you must forfeit that
to your client,
to my client.
And what is the legal basis for that determination by the district court, A, and B, how does that affect, if at all, the standards of review that your friend across the aisle is arguing apply?
Let's see if I understand both parts of your question.
Yeah.
One is, Your Honor, the evidence which they don't challenge. The findings of fact, conclusions of the law, if you look at conclusion number 5, has a whole host of breaches. It lists them in letter form, A through however many. They don't claim any error in that list of breaches. They're not saying we didn't actually breach the operating agreement. We didn't actually aid and abet Mr. Holman in the breach of his fiduciary duties. They're not saying that, okay? And so if those breaches of contract and fiduciary duty are not challenged, neither is the law that you cannot profit from a breach of contract. You cannot keep the profits from a breach of fiduciary duty.
But the one who's harmed by those breaches is the one who gets that.
And that includes Azteca, because this was a company opportunity. This was an opportunity for Essex and its members.
But if they can't prove that they would have been able to participate financially and had the wherewithal to do it, how did they have a right to share in that?
Well, that was my answer earlier. At what point, what were we required to show that we were willing and able to do? Buy the Landco units back in 2018 for $0, which is what Landco gave them to Holman for? What were we required to show we were willing and able to do? Take an upfront cost-free opportunity to engage lawyers on a contingency fee to fight the lenders under the ancient mortgage statute? Who couldn't have had the ability to put forth $0 and undergo this opportunity? Who couldn't have talked to the Series A preferred members, as you suggested earlier, and said, let's all share in this opportunity, which, if the manager had abided by his duties and followed what the operating agreement required, was what would have happened. And that is where breach of contract seeks to put the injured party in the place that it would have enjoyed but for those breaches. That's what should have happened. It didn't happen, and our ability to prove that something could have happened that was never presented to us really must fall on the party who prevented us from having that opportunity.
Thank you.
I see that I don't have much time left, so I will be as brief as I can. First, on the effect of other members being affected unit holders, I'm sure the court is aware in our reply brief, page 13, footnote 8, we address all that. If you take all that out, it wouldn't have affected any of the votes, and I would have hoped that Mr. Garner would have read that as well and have had some comment on that. That you don't have to show that you would have gotten money, absolutely you do. This court held as much in Bader versus Sari, 96 Nevada, 352, that the burden is on the person seeking lost profit damage to show with reasonable certainty that but for the breach, you would have gotten profit, not could have, would have. I know we're here to decide this one controversy between the parties, but all the decisions that this court ultimately makes are either persuasive or binding authority on all litigants in Nevada. And ponder the circumstance that Mr. Garner is presenting to this court, that the rule should be a party seeking lost profit damages can come into a court and have a person merely testify without any supporting evidence of any comparable comparison to any other business entity. I could have done that, And for that to be enough to award lost profit damages, I think works a great deal of mischief. And that is why Corbin's own contracts, section 56.17 and 56.19. That's why the restatement second of contract, section 352, comment B. That's why volume 22 of American jurisprudence second, section 58, all say the same thing.
Do those cases and authorities apply to a breach, a claim that there was aiding and abetting of a breach of fiduciary duty?
Aiding and abetting still requires proof of damages. And so I think if you're seeking lost profit damages, that it still would apply. Yes.
Okay. Justice, may I ask a question? Sort of on a different topic, but I didn't squeeze it in earlier. Judge Denton, besides ruling in the opposing party's favor on the counterclaims, also granted judgment against your client on their claim for declaratory relief. To what extent have you made an argument that was unsupported and should be reversed?
I think our position on that, Your Honor, I'll be as brief as I can, is that our right to declaratory relief intertwined with the arguments that we proffered in our summary judgment motion below. Given that Azteca couldn't proffer any evidence showing that it would take from the estate and suffered any damages from any conduct that Royal engaged in, then declaratory relief was appropriate. And I think insofar as under these circumstances that Azteca had no right to the bankruptcy estate as it exists now, I believe that they asked for more in declaratory relief below. Not only that, but that
no, the right. I'm talking about your client's request for declaration.
Yeah, I believe that they're both intertwined with our summary judgment arguments. Unless the court has further questions to submit.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the oral.